Kunjabihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Gopi Chanda Balaba Girvadir Hari. Gopi Chanda Balaba Girvadir Hari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachariya Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi
Jai Om Vishnupad, Paramahamsa, Parabraj, Gachara, Sotera, Satishri, Shimanis, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, ISKCON Founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Samaved Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaura Premananda, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Sadhguru, Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta, Swami Tanamani, Namaste Saraswati, and Guru, the Rangi China, Nivishesha Shunga Hari Pasta Chavisa. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 5, Text 30. Chapter is the cause of all causes. Vaikarani kan mano jagne.
Vaikarani kan mano jagne.
Deva vakarika dasha.
Deva vakarika dasha.
Digvatarka pracheto svi. Vanindro Pendra Mitraka
Vanindro Pendra Mitraka
Vaikari Khan Mano Jagne
Vaikari Khan Mano Jagne
Deva Vaikari Kadasha
Deva Vaikari Kadasha
Digvatarka Pracheto Svi
Digvatarka Pracheto Svi
Vanindro Pendra Mitraka Vaikarikan mano jagne
Vaikarikan mano jagne
Deva vaikarika dasha
Deva vaikarika dasha
Digvatarka pracheto svi
Digvatarka pracheto svi
Vanendro pendra mitraka
Vanendro pendra mitraka
Amen.
Vaikarikat.
Vaikarikat.
From the mode of goodness.
From the mode of goodness.
Mana. The mind.
The mind.
Jagne.
Jagne.
Generated.
Generated.
Deva.
Deva.
Demigods.
Vaikarika.
Vaikarika.
In the mode of goodness.
Dasha.
Dasha.
Ten.
Ten.
Deep. The controller of directions.
Vata.
The controller of air.
Arka.
The sun.
Pracheta.
Varuna.
Ashvi.
The Ashvini Kumaras.
Vani.
The fire god.
Indra.
The king of heaven.
Upendra.
The deity in heaven.
Mitra.
One of the 12 Adityas.
Ka.
Prajapati Brahma. Translation, a purport by Srila Prabhupada. From the mode of goodness, the mind is generated and becomes manifest, as also the 10 demigods controlling the bodily movements. Such demigods are known as the controller of the directions, the controller of air, the sun god, the father of Daksha Prajapati, the Ashvini Kumaras, the fire god, the king of heaven, the worshipable deity in heaven, the chief of the Adityas, and Brahmaji, the Prajapati. All come into existence. Purport of Srila Prabhupada. Vaikarika is the neutral stage of creation, and Tejas is the initiative of creation, while Tamas is the full display of material creation under the spell of the darkness of ignorance. I usually don't like to stop in the middle of Srila Prabhupada's purports because I like everyone to hear the full continuity, but Prabhupada sort of abruptly changes gears here and goes into a very, very different topic. So I just want to stop at this point. Here, Vaikarikat is mentioned, which means a hunkar in the mode of goodness or false ego in the mode of goodness. It generates the mind in demigods controlling the directions and bodily movements. And the false ego in tamas, Prabhupada says, is the full display of creation under the spell of darkness of ignorance. Now, Prabhupada does not further comment on this verse. But he really discusses some much very, very important larger issues, which we'll get into and talk about that. I also just to kind of check that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary just basically repeats the content of the verse, and Jiva Goswami in his commentary in Bhagavatam doesn't say too much more either, just adds that the mind is much like chitta. And both of them mention that the Upendra here is not Vamanadeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but it's a demigod by that name, just so that's clear, because later it mentions that these don't have full power, and obviously Vamadeva would have full power as an incarnation of God. So now we're going to continue Prabhupada's purport when he discusses some really, really important issues very nicely. Okay, he says, after saying that the material creation is under the spell of darkness of ignorance, and that's really what he's going to be discussing. Manufacture of the necessities of life in factories and workshops, excessively prominent in the age of Kali or in the age of machine, is the summit stage of the quality of darkness. Such manufacturing enterprises by human society are in the mode of darkness because factually there's no necessities for the commodities manufactured. Human society primarily requires food for subsistence, shelter for sleeping, defense for protection, and commodities for satisfaction of the senses. The senses are the practical signs of life, as will be explained in the next verse. Human civilization is meant for purifying the senses, and objects of sense satisfaction should be supplied as much as absolutely required, but not for aggravating artificial sensory needs. Food, shelter, defense, and sense gratification are all needs in material existence. Otherwise, in his pure, uncontaminated state of original life, the living entities has no such needs. The needs are therefore artificial, and in the pure state of life, there are no such needs. Of course, that means in our spiritual body, in the spiritual world. As such, increasing the artificial needs, as is in the standard of material civilization, or advancing the economic development of human society, is a sort of engagement in darkness without knowledge. By such engagement, human energy is spoiled, because human energy is primarily meant for purifying the senses in order to engage them in satisfying the senses of the Lord. The Supreme Lord, being the supreme possessor of spiritual senses, is the master of the senses, Rishikesh. Rishika means the senses, and Isha means the master. The Lord is not the servant of the senses, or in other words, he is not directed by the dictation of the senses, but the conditioned soul or the individual living entities are servants of the senses. They are conducted by the direction and dictation of the senses, and therefore, material civilization is a kind of engagement in sense gratification only. The standard of human civilization should be to cure the disease of sense gratification, and one can do this simply by becoming an agent for satisfying the spiritual senses of the Lord. The senses are never to be stopped in their engagement, but one should purify them by engaging them in the pure service of sense gratification of the master of the senses. This is the instruction of the whole Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna wanted first of all to satisfy his own senses by his decision not to fight with his kinsmen and friends. But Lord Sri Krishna taught him the Bhagavad Gita just to purify Arjuna's decision for sense gratification. Therefore, Arjuna agreed to satisfy the senses of the Lord, and thus he fought the battle of Kurukshetra as the Lord desired. The Vedas instruct us to get out of the darkness, the existence of darkness, and go forward into the path of light. Tamasi ma jyotirgama. And I looked that up, and it's from the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad 1.3.28, and Prabhupada gives the full sort of verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Majjhalila. He says it means, lead me from untruth to truth, lead me from darkness to light, lead me from death to immortality. Nice verse, nice prayer. So, continuing on, the path of light is therefore to satisfy the senses of the Lord. Misguided men or less intelligent men follow the path of self-realization without any attempt to satisfy the transcendental senses of the Lord by following the path shown by Arjuna and other devotees of the Lord. On the contrary, they artificially try to stop the activities of the senses, yoga system, or they deny the transcendental senses of the Lord, jnana system. The devotees, however, are above the yogis and jnanis because pure devotees do not deny the senses of the Lord. They want to satisfy the senses of the Lord. Only because of the darkness of ignorance do the yogis and jnanis deny the senses of the Lord and thus artificially try to control the activities of the diseased senses. In the diseased condition, the senses, there's too much engagement of the senses' increasing material needs. When one comes to see the disadvantage of aggravating sense activity, one is called a jnani. And when one tries to stop the activities of the senses by the practice of yoga principles, he is called a yogi. But when one is fully aware of the transcendental senses of the Lord and tries to satisfy his senses, one is called a devotee of the Lord. The devotees of the Lord do not try to deny the senses of the Lord, nor do they artificially stop the actions of the senses, but they do voluntarily engage the purified senses in the service of the master of the senses. That was done by Arjuna, thereby easily attaining the perfection of satisfying the Lord, the ultimate goal of all perfection. Om Gyana Tivarandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurunvikamina Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Panchakalpa Trivishcha Kripa Sindhubibhacha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnabhibhyo Namo Namaha. So Srila Prabhupada first says that the emphasis of basic human necessities is food, shelter, and some sense gratification, and some defense. But when it's in excessive, it becomes in the mode of darkness, tamas, and spoils the human life. So the purpose of modern civilization, according to Srila Prabhupada in his purport, is to increase material needs and excessive sense gratification. In other words, so much of the manufacturing, so much of the industrial activity is not just to satisfy the basic needs, including, and Prabhupada says, including sense gratification. In other words, we all have senses and, you know, they require a certain amount, I guess you could say, of gratification, but not sinful, not excessive, you know, and not more than what is needed. So that's the point here. So, in other words, when we are able to get away from this idea of just trying to increase sense gratification, material prosperity, wealth, trying to develop our material position, then we can focus on the real purpose of life, which is God realization and devotional service. And the more that the society and civilization focuses on the increase of material life and material possessions, then it the real purpose is lost. It totally distracts one from the idea or the purpose of trying to develop our bhakti, our devotional service to Krishna. So, and thus, the living entity becomes, Prabhupada says, the servant of the senses. Rather than serving God, he was serving the senses. And it is conducted by, and his life is conducted by the direction or the dictation of those senses, either gross or subtle. So it either is by the gross senses or by the mind, intelligence, and false ego. And that's all kind of described in these verses, which, you know, talk about the way that material development comes about, or the way that a whole material creation systematically comes about by one process after another. So Prabhupada doesn't put a whole lot of emphasis on the technicalities of it, but really, what does it mean? We can understand the material life is quite complex. It has a very distinct source of development and creation, which is totally controlled by Krishna. That Krishna has all of this unfold in a certain way, and then we have to understand how we are entrapped in this material world within these three modes of nature, within false ego, and how we can get out of those modes of nature. So the coverings of the gross and subtle body are very difficult to overcome, and they're developed over many lifetimes. And these experiences cause distress, they cause mental disturbance to us, and we also see as devotees, they tend to impede our progress in spiritual life often. And there's two sources of these. One is called anartas, which are unwanted habits from past conditioning. There's so many things, maybe material activities or material gratification that we are attracted to because of a past condition, either this lifetime or another. Or what's called samskaras, which are unwanted impressions in the mind. And I think we all experience it. Sometimes even you're chanting, you know, I've experienced this anyway, and some just past thought or past experience comes into the mind. You think, where does that come from, right? You know, like some song you heard 40 years ago, you know, it's like, why is, you know. So you basically, it seems like we're almost bombarded by these, you know, unwanted activities, unwanted impressions. And that's, they're very deep mental impressions formed over this lifetime and last lifetime. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Jivadharma says there's two types of these samskaras. Or there's praktana, which is from the past, and adunika, which is from the present life, which, you know, we can understand. Sometimes there are things that we don't even think about, like phobias. Sometimes you'll see someone just has this unnatural fear of something like lightning or storms or water, whatever it might be, dogs, you know. And often that's not from the experience in this lifetime, but from a previous lifetime where something negative may have happened by those different types of elements. Okay, so these samskaras tend, Bhaktivinoda says, help to develop and frame your mental constitution, your temperament, and your contemplations. So when you think of mental constitution, temperament, contemplations, that's a lot of what we think of as our personality. And this is where so many people have difficulty, because people think their personality that they manifest is them, when actually it's really a product of mind, intelligence, ego, and it's formed from all of these different samskaras and all these past impressions, which help us to develop what we say the person we are today. But that's not the person we are today. That is a material covering of the real person, which is inside. And that is what we are trying to develop in Krishna consciousness, the jiva, the atma, that is within the coverings of these material bodies. A little more about this. This is from a room conversation, July 6, 1976, which discusses the contamination of consciousness and how it comes about. And I picked this one because I was very fortunate that I was in this room conversation with Srila Prabhupada in Potomac in Washington, D.C. in 1976. It was very interesting because all the scientists from the Bhaktivedanta Institute were there, along with Rupanuga, who was our GBC, and others. And so it starts out Sarup Damodar, he was brahmachari at the point. He reads a purport to a Bhagavatam verse that said, when consciousness is polluted by material contamination, this is called ahankara. And that's what they start discussing. Rupanuga says, so the consciousness can be contaminated according to the mode which it's associating. Prabhupada says, yes, prakriti jan gunan. Sarup Damodar says, actually, consciousness is a symptom of life. So when we say contaminated consciousness, the quality of life is there, but somehow, Prabhupada said, it's mixed with material modes. Yes. Rupanuga, originally it is goodness, pure goodness, you say, everything in the beginning. Prabhupada says, I give the example, just like water falling from the sky, it is crystal clear, it is still water, but as soon as it touches the earth, it becomes muddy. But that muddiness can be filtered. Rupanuga says, plus, muddiness is the character of the mud, not the consciousness, and it can be cleansed, filtered out. Prabhupada, yes. That filtering process is the process of devotional service. So unless the water is different from precipitated matter, how can it be filtered? In other words, Prabhupada is saying the original spirit soul itself is not contaminated, but it becomes mixed with the modes of nature. And the process of bhakti is that filtering process, we're sort of removing all the mud, you know, the mud from the mirror of the mind. And so we need to work to become free of these mental conditionings. And that process of sadhana, of course, is sadhana bhakti, purifies the mind. And when the heart is cleansed, the mind is cleared, then one is able to more and more experience Krishna. This cleansing process, Prabhupada also described, talking about the first Shikshastika verse. It says, Marjanam means to cleanse, and Darpanam means mirror. The heart is a mirror. It is just like a camera. Just as a camera takes all kinds of pictures day and night, our heart takes pictures and keeps them in an unconscious state. Psychologists know this. The heart takes so many pictures, and therefore it becomes covered. We do not know when it begun, when it has begun, but it is a fact. Because there's material contact, our real identity is covered. Therefore, cheto darpana marginam, one has to cleanse the heart. So, brings up, of course, the next important point. What is this process? How do we clean the heart? How do we become free from this material consciousness, the contamination, the pollution of the mind and the senses by the material modes of nature? And this is, of course, Prabhupada discusses this quite a bit in today's purport, how the devotee serves the senses of Krishna. He makes this point several times. He said, this is just quoting from the purport today, the devotees are above the yogis and jnanis because pure devotees do not deny the senses of the Lord. They want to satisfy the senses of the Lord. Then later, the devotees of the Lord do not try to deny the senses of the Lord, nor do they artificially stop the action of the senses, but they do voluntarily engage the purified senses in the service of the master of the senses, as was done by Arjuna, thereby easily attaining perfection of satisfying the Lord, the ultimate goal of all perfection. Can someone get me a glass of water? I'm going to lose my voice, I think. Thank you. So, Prabhupada says, a Krishna is called Hrishikesh. Hrishikesh means the master of the senses. Hrishika means senses, and Isha means master. So, in Bhakti Yoga, the devotee neither overindulges the senses, as we've been discussing, but he also does not deny the senses. So the bhakta engages the senses in the service of Krishna, who is Hrishikesh, the master of the senses. And of course, the well-known verse, Sarva Padi Vinir Muktam Tat Paravetna Paradvena Nirmala Hrishikena Hrishikesha Sevanam Bhakta Ruchite. That's from Narada Pancharatna, and Prabhupada quotes it several times, Chaitanya Charitamrita and Nectar of Devotion. Translation, very important verse. Bhakti or devotional service means engaging all of our senses in the service of the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Master of all senses. When the spirit soul renders service unto the Supreme, there are two side effects. One is freed from all material designations, and when senses are purified, simply by being employed in the service of the Lord. So, very important understanding. So the satisfaction of material senses leads to unhappiness. And that's not our natural position. So therefore, we need to minimize sense gratification, only take that which is needed. And Srila Prabhupada mentions that in response to this unhappiness, distress, caused by material life, many people try, like especially the jnanis and yogis, try to artificially stop or deny the senses. In other words, the senses are causing me distress, Therefore, I deny the senses. You know, I try to, you know, disengage from them. But it's not possible. A desire for liberation is understandable because the material world is a place of suffering. An intelligent person tires material life after lifetimes of suffering. So the jnani tries to become free of material bondage and break that attachment. Srila Prabhupada once said, kind of a famous quote, about this process of negation. He said, negation of material does not establish a spiritual fact. I think that's just a wonderful summary in just a few short words. In other words, that kind of refutes what the jnanis and yogis are trying to do. Negating the material is not spiritual. In other words, the spiritual life is not just no material life. It's something of and in itself, something unique, something very, of course, incredible and wonderful and powerful. You know, the spiritual energy, the spiritual life, which comes directly from Swayam Bhagavan, Sri Krishna. So the devotees also wish to be free from the modes of nature and taking birth. But the devotee is not attracted to this process of liberation. It's because there's much greater pleasure and satisfaction in bhakti. In the Hari Bhakti Sahudaya, it is said, "My dear Lord, O Supreme, simply by understanding you or seeing you, the pleasure which we derive is so great that the pleasure of Brahmananda becomes insignificant." In other words, the pleasure that is there in Brahman realization, understanding, pure spiritual energy, existence in the sat teacher, or the is very, very little compared to bhakti, compared to what the devotee experiences. It says that the water in the footprint of a calf is compared to Brahmananda is compared to the pleasure of devotional service, which is an ocean. So the superior principle, not to deny the senses, of course, is yukta vairagya. But we want to use everything in Krishna's service. And when we engage that service of the senses to Krishna, that is yukta vairagya, which of course is described in three very important verses in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. In 1.2.254, it says, if a person has a taste for worshipping the Lord, even if he has strong material attraction, those attractions will be for the most part destroyed during sadhana without resorting to vairagya. And that would be the practice of the jnanis and yogas, referring to vairagya, trying to really control themselves, control the senses. And says it's not necessary, Rupa Goswami says. And Jiva Goswami, in his commentary on this verse, says that vairagya is actually condemned as the heart will become hardened. In other words, those who are overly austere, trying to deny everything, their heart becomes hard. And a devotee's heart is soft. A devotee's heart is open. A devotee's heart is loving. If one is overly severe, there's very little room for love, and without love, where's bhakti? Bhakti is love and devotion, directed towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the heart needs to be open towards that. But then, he also says that without some vairagya, how does one control the senses? And of course, the example of his the next verse of yukta vairagya. Lost it here, sorry. Rupa Goswami, this is Prabhupada's in a lecture, this is Prabhupada's translation of 1.2.255. Rupa Goswami says that as long as we are in this material world, we have to act. We cannot cease acting. Therefore, if action is performed and the fruits are given to Krishna, then it is called yukta vairagya. Then the next verse says, rejection of things related to the Lord by persons desiring liberation, who think that these are simply material objects, is called useless vairagya, or palghu. So the jnanis and yogis try to stop the activities of the senses, which is artificial, and Rupa Goswami says it is useless. And of course, Prabhupada spoke on this topic of yukta vairagya many times, even from the very first lectures. This was a topic that Prabhupada, I think if you look on the Veda base, you can see hundreds, if not thousands, if you put in yukta vairagya, Prabhupada quotes. And he also gave so many examples. he would say this, you know, one we all remember probably, is he'd say this dictaphone that we were using is a material object. But since we are using it in Krishna's service, it is no longer material. It is acting spiritually. And so the use of technology, if we're, you know, preaching, and, you know, or whatever, on the internet or whatever it may be, it's no longer material. It becomes spiritualized. Because anything in the utilization of the pure spiritual energy of the Lord, Krishna, takes on those same qualities of spirituality. So the point is that we want to look at what is the real purpose, the real interest of the jiva. And that's what Prabhupada is discussing a lot about this. Because Prabhupada says in the natural state, it's kind of interesting, says the jiva has no material senses. Prabhupada says, otherwise, in his pure uncontaminated state of original life, the living entity has no such needs. The needs are therefore artificial. In the pure state, there are no needs. Of course, the pure Atma, the pure jiva, who is, you know, purely spiritual, has no need for material sense objects or material senses for that matter. But it doesn't mean that he is inert, because he has spiritual senses and a spiritual body. So those spiritual senses, the difference, of course, is they have, it's described, they have no independent motive, anmita, outside of Krishna. They don't work and exist separately from Krishna. The spiritual senses would have, you know, just no, I think this was discussed in some previous purports, in this chapter, in some previous classes, that without the presence of the super soul, the senses can't really act, the jiva can't really act, the jiva can't even enter other bodies, and of course there would be really no energy or consciousness without not only the soul, but the presence of the super soul. And when that super soul, when the soul is pure, then it's acting completely in conjunction with the super soul and not separately. Now, the greatest enjoyment for the jiva is service of the senses of Krishna. Therefore, devotional service is the real interest of the Atma. And this is kind of a difficult concept for people in the beginning to understand. How can, if I just serve God, how does that make me happy? Or serving Krishna's senses. How do we serve Krishna's senses? We do it all the time. We offer food to Krishna. We offer flowers. We offer so many things for Krishna's enjoyment, for his senses. Just basic activity, service that we do is for Krishna, to please Krishna, please, of course, through the spiritual master, or please the spiritual master and his instructions, which is non-different than pleasing Krishna. So we do this all the time. And so how does this really make the soul happy? It's kind of a deeper, interesting question. Very important, another very important verse, Ate vidu svarta katim hi vishnum, Darshaya ye bahirarta manina. That's from 7531, Srimad Bhagavatam. Prahlad Maharaj, I assume, right? He says, persons who are strongly entrapped by the consciousness of enjoying material life, and therefore accepted as their leader or guru, a similar blind man attached to external sense objects cannot understand the goal of life is to return home back to Gaya and engage in service of Lord Vishnu. Atevidu sartik tami Vishnu. The real purpose of life is service of Vishnu or Krishna. Now, on an even deeper level, we can understand the super soul, or Krishna directly, is more dear to the soul than our very own selves. We hear this sometimes in the 10th canto, in the chapters of the gopis and the rasa dance, they'll say things like, Krishna is more dear than my own life. Like more, and of course they're talking completely on a spiritual level, not just material body. So how can that be? When you think about it, how can Krishna be more dear than their own life or their own existence? Well, it's described in a couple places in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which are kind of interesting. First of all, in 10.22.26, this is Krishna speaking to the wives of the Brahmins, you know, after they've completely surrendered to him. He says, certainly expert personalities who can see their own true interest render unmotivated and interrupted devotional service directly unto me, for I am most dear to the soul. So we see that you know, Krishna is very, very, very dear to the soul. And that is what is very pleasing for us. That's what we want to experience. We want to be in association of Radha and Krishna, or Krishna in Vrindavan. That's really what our whole sampradaya is really directed towards. There's so many other ways to understand Krishna and different avatars of Krishna, but really, if we look at, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the six Goswamis, we're really looking at the Vrindavan pastimes of Krishna mostly, which is what we are aiming at. Not so much Dwarka. Although they're wonderful pastimes and we enjoy them, appreciate them, most of us, I think, are attracted to the pastimes of Krishna's Vrajabhumi pastimes in Vrindavan. So, another very interesting place in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto. This is, of course, the Brahma Mahana Leela, where Brahma steals the cows and the calves, and Krishna, of course, expands himself as all of the calves, all of the boys, also the boys, and he becomes them for 1 year. And so he takes on their exact forms, and so all the mothers are taking care of their children who are actually Krishna, and all the cows, the female cows, are taking care of calves who are actually Krishna. And they experience the most wonderful enjoyment. And of course, Krishna does so many things. He wanted to show Brahma certain things. He wanted to perform different activities. But probably most importantly, he wanted to give the experience, and he wanted to give the opportunity for all of the elderly, the gopas who are mothers, as opposed to the young gopis, and the fathers too. There's even an example of the fathers. Remember that one when the cows took off and ran down the hill? They were so excited, and they usually don't break away. They keep the cows away from the calves so all the milk's not gone, because even when the calves are very old, and any of you who have had cows will know this, you can see a 3-4-year-old cow is bigger than the mother will try to nurse still. So they have to separate them at a certain point, or they won't get any milk. The calf will get it all, and the calf doesn't need it. They can eat grass by that point. Anyway, the mothers were just so enamored, they ran down the hill, broke away, and were feeding their calves. And then the coward men were angry. Our cows got away from us. And they ran down the hill after them. And then they saw all the boys there that were taking care of the cows and calves, who were their sons, of course. And they became so overwhelmed and picked up their sons and kissed them and loved them, they forgot all about, they didn't care about the cows anymore. Okay, so what? And it was very, very overwhelming. And even Balaram was amazed by this. So anyway, after this year, and they had this wonderful opportunity, and then, of course, the whole thing happens. Brahma comes back. He's totally bewildered, because not only has Krishna turned into the calves and the boys, then he sees them as complete Vishnu forms, four-handed Vishnu forms, all the boys, all the calves, and they have, the universe with them, everything. They are, each one of them are complete controllers of the universe, thousands of them. And he, at this point, he gives up. He is so overwhelmed, and he realizes his little tiny mystic power is nothing compared to Krishna Yogeshwara, the master of all mystic power. And so, of course, he surrenders, and then he gives wonderful prayers, which many of us know and read in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto. Very, very nice prayers. And then when he ends, another part, which we don't always remember so much, at the very end of the chapter, it's back to Parikshit and Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadeva Goswami. And Maharaj Parikshit, at the end, asks a question. He says in verse 49, King Parikshit said, "O Brahman, how could the coward women have developed for Krishna, someone else's son, such unprecedented pure love, love they never felt even for their own children? Please explain this." Of course, Maharaj Parikshit asks all these questions. He knows the answer. But for us, for our benefit, to clarify and let Shukadeva Goswami explain this incredible fact, he asks the question. In other words, they had more love for Krishna as their son than they had for their own sons. Now, those of us who have children think, wow, we love our own children so much. But it's not that hard to imagine. If you had Krishna as your son, pretty incredible, right? Pretty wonderful having little baby Krishna there. So naturally, they're all just in ecstasy having Krishna as their son. So Shukadeva, so the next five verses, Shukadeva Swami explains this. And he starts kind of from the beginning and works up. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, "O king, for every created being, the dearmost thing is certainly his own self. The dearness of everything else, children, wealth, and so on, is due only to the dearness of the self. Okay, we can understand that, you know, basic everyone, self-centered. For this reason, O best of kings, the embodied soul is self-centered. He's more attached to his own body and self than so-called possessions like children, wealth, and home. Indeed, for persons who think the body is the self, O best of kings, those things whose importance lies only in their relationship to the body are never as dear as the body itself. If a person comes to the stage of considering the body mine instead of me, in other words, more spiritual understanding, he will not consider the body as dear to his own self. After all, even if the body is growing old and useless, one's desire continues living remains strong. Therefore, it is his own self that is most dear to every embodied living being, and it is simply for the satisfaction of this self that the whole creation of moving, non-moving entities exist. You should know Krishna to be the original soul of all living entities. For the benefit of the whole universe, he has, out of his causeless mercy, appeared as an ordinary human being. He's done this by the strength of his internal potency. Those in the world who understand Lord Krishna as he is, sees all things, stationary and moving, as manifest forms of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such enlightened persons recognize no reality apart from the Supreme Lord Krishna. In other words, everything is part of Krishna, including ourselves. There would be no jivas without Krishna, right? We are Tatashta Shakti. We are an energy, an expansion of Krishna, as everything is in your world. You know, the Prakriti. You know, everything is coming in. And so an enlightened person understands there's nothing, including myself, outside of Krishna. Our existence is dependent upon him. Our enjoyment is totally dependent upon him. Everything that we feel and experience, and of course it's a very wonderful experience in the spiritual world, is all because of Krishna. Now, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, to in verse 54, this is his purport. He says, this verse establishes the conclusion of the discussion. When one sees the truth, he realizes that the individual spirit soul is only an intermediate object of love. The final, highest object of love is Sri Krishna alone. Brahma says, Krishna is the soul of the universe, and the super soul presents in the hearts of all conditioned souls. A person loves children and other persons because they bring pleasure to the material body. In the same way, a person loves his own material body because it brings pleasure to himself, the spirit soul. Also, in the same way, a person loves his true self, his spiritual identity, because it brings pleasure to the super soul. The super soul is Sri Krishna, whose spiritual form is perfect and complete. Nice explanation. I can't say I absolutely 100% totally understand that, because it's very, very, very deep, but I think it gives us a nice glimpse, a nice insight, and how that love for Krishna is so deep, so intrinsic, so internal. Every one of us, that is our identity. To love Krishna, to be, you know, feel ourselves as part and parcel of Krishna. So the conclusion is, because Krishna is the highest object of love, the greatest love is felt for him. Thus the Vrajagopis, I'm sorry, that's still part of the purport. Thus the Vrajagopis love Krishna even more than they love their own sons. So regaining our true position of the Atma, or the conditioned soul, is the purpose of life. And it's kind of one of those ironies, it's hard for materialistic people to understand, that by surrendering, one becomes liberated, becomes free. But by struggling independently in this material world, one is conditioned and controlled by the modes of nature. So do you want to be controlled by the modes of nature and suffer, or do you want to accept willingly your natural, you know, subservient position, be controlled by Krishna, and experience a life of eternity, knowledge, and bliss? I think that's a little better deal. That's a better choice for us living entities. So our loss of freedom is really due to the control of material energy, which, as Prabhupada says, dictates, controls, and, you know, completely moves us in certain directions. And the real freedom is to become free of the material modes of nature and align ourselves with Krishna's desires, utilizing everything in this material world for his service. And then our greatest natural love is for the source of the soul, Krishna. And we are pleased when Krishna's senses are pleased. That's the point that's being made here. So when Krishna's senses are pleased, what happens? We become completely happy. And there are many examples of this in the Bhagavatam, especially in the 10th canto, in the different pastimes of Krishna and the different devotees. you know, when they are serving Krishna or feeding Krishna, they become so completely happy. And I think we can understand this even materially. Sometimes, especially you might see it particularly with children and parents, that, you know, if the child, the parent does something for the child and the child is really happy, then the parent becomes even more happy. Or let's say even in a relationship with a husband and wife or, you know, a partner, and let's say you give some gift, and your partner, your wife, your husband becomes really, just loves it, is really happy. That makes you more happy, doesn't it? Right? I mean, they say it's more better to give than receive. I mean, it's actually true. When you please someone you love, when you please them and please their senses, it's even more pleasing to you. So what to speak of, those are just material examples. What to speak of our relationship with Krishna. And spiritually, when we please Krishna by our service, even if it's a tiny amount of service, Krishna accepts any little service. It doesn't have to be that we're on the level of Nanda Maharaj or the gopis or something. Krishna accepts it, and we feel reciprocation. And that's really the whole point in spiritual life, that there's reciprocation. It's an exchange. It's not that we surrender to Krishna, we serve his senses, and somehow we're just like unhappy slaves or something. That's material conception. In the spiritual world, it's complete happiness. Because we're situated properly in our constitutional position. And a constitutional position includes ananda. There is a complete bliss and happiness that the living entity experiences in relationship to Krishna. You know, so Prabhupada has given us this wonderful process, this philosophy that it really explains what is going on, what is happening in this material world, how to get out of this material world, and how to attain the highest state of our natural happiness, which is serving the senses, Rishikesh of Krishna. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Questions, comments? There's one up front here, too. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for the nice class. I just want two references. You were reading a long paragraph about how even attachment to children is because they are ours. That mm-hmm. paragraph reference, a very nice one. And that pleasure of serving you is compared to the ocean, whereas pleasure of serving us is footprint of calves. Mm-hmm. Cow. Yeah, those two references, please. Where are they from?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Was there?
That's it. I just want references.
Okay.
But I can go back.
Right. Okay. Okay, here.
Hare Krishna. Mataji is requesting if you can tell what references were there.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want to know the reference to those?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were reading it, but you had the reference there. Okay. Rejection.
I think one was the verse from Bhagavatam you were reading, 10th canto, the self.
Oh, that was 14th chapter. Verses 49 to 55. 49 was Prabhupada's question, and 50 was Shukadeva's answer for the next five verses or so, six verses. Okay?
Thank you.
And looking for that other one, let's see, where were we? Close the heart, close the heart. Specifically what? The one of the water in the calf's footprint. Anybody know that offhand? I can't find it. Oh, there was one here in Hari Bhakta Suhudaya, but I didn't put down where in Prabhupada's books he quotes it. So, anybody have any? Okay. Go ahead.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhuji, for a beautiful lecture. I was wondering in the particular shloka which you read today, 2.5.30, where it is mentioned about these demigods and trying to see, you know, Prabhupada's purport, where he's mentioning in detail about, you know, like you explained, senses and how Krishna senses have to be served.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand how in this particular shloka Prabhupada is mentioning these things. What is the connection?
Oh, what was the connection? It's interesting because he basically took like sort of the last couple words of the translation and took it from there. Basically says like Vaikarika is neutral stage, Tejas the initial creation. Vaikarika, of course, is mode of goodness, and sometimes it's described as a hunkar in the mode of goodness. Tejas, passion, rajas. Tamas, the full display of material creation, spelled dark as ignorance. So that's what he's really talking about. This tamas as the under the material creation, how it's the darkness of ignorance. So that's really what he's talking about. You know, the darkness of ignorance in the material world, and then he goes from there, and how we get out of that. So that's basically, like I said, that's where he didn't really discuss so much about the content of the verse, and the other acharyas didn't either, so who am I to try to talk about it? And I don't know much about it. But, you know, it's pretty obvious. I mean, you have the demigods who control the directions and controller of the different parts of the body. All of these. And that's discussed more in other places. You know, this subject's discussed several times in Bhagavatam, isn't it? In the third canto, we get the whole story of creation again and expansion. I think other places too. So it's a repeating theme, and we'll hear more about creation again.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Mati?
I was thinking that it's amazing that you're talking how our soul intrinsically loves Krishna more. Yeah? I mean, and how much we are so covered. I guess that's the thought came to my mind as you were talking about that. And this morning what caught me attention was that parrot on Krishna's staff. And now he's totally looking in the opposite direction of Krishna. He's not facing Krishna. I kind of like made me think, that's the sad part, that we're totally facing away from Krishna, but in reality we love Krishna more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just amazing thing that you're expressing today.
It is. This isn't a real simple concept, and it's not something that we can say, oh, sure, yeah, I know that, I understand that, I experienced that. No, not so much until we're, you know, fairly advanced, or we have those moments, I think, you know. We all have, fortunately, there's those flashes of inspiration or revelation, realization that we get sometimes where we can, you know, sort of see that love for Krishna, you know, and how it's greater than everything, you know. And repeatedly, you know, sometimes we think of Paramatma, oh, it's the super soul in the heart, but Paramatma is much more than that. Paramatma, and that's what we hear a lot through the Bhagavatam, it pervades everything. Everything in the material world is basically based upon Paramatma. There is really nothing that can happen, you know, who was saying in class that, you know, the spirit soul can't even enter a body without Paramatma? Somebody mentioned it. Maybe Shesha. I don't know. But, I think it's quite a concept to contemplate. I agree.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wish I had full realization of it rather than just intellectual.
So one thing was, in the beginning of the lecture, when you're talking about and lead us into immortality.
And what?
Yeah, and lead us into immortality.
Oh, yeah.
Where was that coming from?
Oh, that was an interesting verse. That Prabhupada mentioned it, Tamasi Majjotirgama, which basically he said, take us away from the darkness and lead us to light. So then I kind of looked it up, and Prabhupada quoted more extensively, more of the full verse. It's from the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. I don't know if we have any access to that or not. I've never really seen it. It said, lead me from untruth to truth, lead me from darkness to light, and lead me from death to immortality. It's somewhere in the Majjalila of Chaitanya Charitamrita. I didn't write down the verse.
Okay.
You could probably look it up. If you could just find a Tamasima Jyotirgama, you could put that into some search and probably find it.
Yeah, I was also thinking that it's such a great leap from like mundane morality, you know, like the, you know, religion and economic development, sense gratification, liberation, that, you know, mundane morality is generally what people think is good, but then for
the highest principle of morality is just to do whatever
Krishna wants. Or serve others, right?
Well, and just like with Arjuna, you know, he was thinking.
Oh.
And
he had a lot of good reasons.
He did.
According to Dharma, you know.
Exactly.
Material
according
dharma.
To mundane morality,
yeah,
correct?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
But then the highest morality, it's like really a big leap from mundane morality to.
Oh, yeah. And it took Krishna about 700 verses to bring to the conclusion, you know, of Sarvadharma Prichaja, you know, give up all of this mundane morality and just surrender to me. That's real religion, right?
And the other thing I was wondering about is, you know, severe austerity. Sometimes, you know, as devotees also perform severe austerities.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it can also lead to a hardening of the heart.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important to study Srila Prabhupada's life.
Right.
Because, you know, he performed the greatest austerities, but he always had this softness about him towards everyone, which we all felt. You know, even as a young girl who, you know, just offered Srila Prabhupada a flower, and he was so kindly reciprocating, thanking for that. But sometimes in the translation, we seem to lose that feeling. And just like the yogis do, performing great austerities, our heart becomes hard.
Yeah.
So it seems like that can also happen within a devotee's life.
Absolutely, and that's why there's warnings against it by the Swamis in the chair. I think I was reading, I've seen this in other places, some of Bhishma Chakravarti Thakura's work, where, you know, he talks about, you know, don't do a lot of unnecessary austerities. And actually, the acharyas mainly emphasize, obviously, the basics of hearing and chanting and remembering. You know, that's really, I always think, you know, sometimes I see, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Sometimes I see, like, during Kartik or something, devotees take on all these sort of odd, weird austerities. You know, now, maybe they are somewhere in the scripture, and maybe some acharya or some devotee did them, so okay, I'm not going to criticize it. But it seems like if we're going to increase austerities, they should be the basic ones that were given to us by Prabhupada and the ones that are really emphasized by the acharyas, hearing, chanting, remembering Krishna. So increase your rounds or increase reading. You know, those are powerful. Increase the 9 processes of devotional service. You know, now we could, you know, we don't need to imitate, you know, somebody like who? Gorky Shortis Babaji, you know, doing severe austerities. No, we're not at that level. Do those things that are appropriate. Now, I've noticed that the acharyas always mention Ekadasi, things like that we should absolutely follow. But doesn't mean, but usually they, you know, fasted the entire day and chanted all night. Prabhupada gave us a very simple fast from grains and beans and try to increase your chanting. You know, so again, like you said, we need to follow the guru and follow the acharyas and not try to invent austerities, or we will have that very strong possibility of just hardening the heart, you know. And that doesn't mean that we should just be loose and not, you know, not perform bhakti properly, not perform our sadhana, you know, but do it in the ways given by guru and the acharyas.
You think of the Bhagavatam, you know, Jambi's path, who was the
Yeah, there should be fear, right? Mm-hmm. You make a mistake and, like, you're going to get cursed. So that seems so uncharacteristic, you know. Like,
and they're not described as the greatest devotees, are they?
No.
Look at Durvasa Muni compared to Ambarish. Ambarish was the great devotee, not Durvasa Muni. Durvasa, who gives this curse, like, almost for no good reason. Of course, it was for reason. Krishna arranges these things. Isn't Durvasa Muni an incarnation of Lord Shiva? I think he is. So, you know, I mean, all these things are arranged, but the example is there. But the kind-hearted Maharaj Ambarish, Krishna completely protects him, and he was the one who triumphed. Right? Yeah.
Like Sukada mentioned, if even devotees performing austerities, their heart can become hard. Mm-hmm. Is the distinction that if one performs any of their devotional service for one's own self-aggrandizement or show, that is what hardens the heart, as opposed to doing it simply for Krishna's guru and Krishna's pleasure, right? Is that the distinction?
Absolutely, and there's very strong warnings about that. I was thinking of some of the... Oh, I just read this. This Manashiksha. It's a really wonderful book. It has Bhaktivinoda's translation and his purports. And they discuss a lot about the practice of devotional service and how you increase all the way up to, you know, Radhing Krishna and Vrindavan. You know how they start, like Nectar of Instruction starts, you know, very simple and ends up Radhakund, you know. So they take you all the way through the process. And Bhakti, you know, mentions it in two or three places about, and as far as these, well, Raghunath Swami mentions obstacles to devotional service. And some of these obstacles are things like a show of devotional service, or try, you know, for ulterior reasons, for prestige. And these are very much condemned. But Raghunath, of course, is so humble. He writes it to his mind, Manasashiksha's instructions to his mind. He says, oh, my mind, please don't do this. And then rather, then he gives the opposite, rather let me focus on, you know, Radha and Krishna or whatever. So yeah, this very important principle. And, you know, it's not just that it's meant for somebody else. It's meant for us. We have to all think about that and remember it. You know, Bhaktivinoda also says that there's three principles to advancing Krishna consciousness. Being determined, being one-pointed, you know, in our direction, and humility.
Yes. Just one more thing. You know, sometimes, you know, someone says something or does something and we become offended, you know? But is it offensive to be offended?
You know? It's offensive to be offended.
Yeah.
Well, we should try to refrain from that. In other words, one of the... Oh, I'm trying to think of the of where it is, of which verse or whatever, but... the idea of not taking offense is a principle, and it's very important. And, you know, like I was reading something, actually, I think Satchinanda Swami was saying, and he said, it's one thing to talk the talk about humility. He said, it's another thing when someone steps on your toe to remain humble. You know? I mean, it's true. You know, the natural reaction often, because of our conditioned nature, is to respond or maybe become a little angry or upset or like that. So it's kind of natural, but it's something we want to actually try to overcome. You know, and we always talk about not criticizing devotees, and that, we know that's an offense, right? We don't want to blaspheme devotees. That's the top elephant, mad elephant offense, or even criticize devotees. And I was reading one of the charges was saying, you really shouldn't criticize anybody because it just, pretend, you know, it kind of keeps up the critical mentality. So don't even criticize non-devotees. Sometimes you need to for the purpose of preaching, right? In other words, it depends upon the motive. Prabhupada would speak strongly for preaching, like against Mayavadis and atheistic scientists, but he wouldn't condemn a Christian, right? What he condemned was Mayavadis, atheistic scientists, like that, people who are misleading people and bringing them away from Krishna. Now that the devotee has to speak strongly about sometimes, but generally speaking, unless there's good reason to please Krishna and for the purpose of preaching, why be critical? And I'm speaking to myself here, because I tend to be a very critical person. I'm really trying to work on that.
Yes, your question, is it offensive to take offense? I can't imagine, I don't know if it's offensive, but our response to that could lead to offense, one. But two, if we can use that, our feeling of being offended, as an alarm that we got to look within. You know, because eating, sleeping, mating, and defending is a big, you know, thing we have to overcome. So that this is just an opportunity, if we get that feeling of being offended, to really look within ourselves.
I love that point, Nagarjuna. You know, in education, they talk about learning moments. So for us, all of us internally have those learning moments. Like, oh, look how I reacted to that. Something I need to work on. You know, I would take it that way. Not that, oh, I'm condemned to some offense, but think, oh, like she was saying, something to examine and learn from. Okay, we should probably end way over time, so. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.